The cashew industry is crying foul today after U.S. peanut farmers broadcast a series of highly negative ads against the country's second favorite snacking nut. According to the ads, those who eat cashews are at risk of choking, losing their eyesight, and even contracting, quote, cancer of the penis. Cashew industry spokesman Harold Garber says the allegations are unfounded.
Once again, we have the peanut just lashing out at anything that threatens its place in the number one spot. It's more sad than anything.
Analysts are calling this the biggest ad blitz of its kind since the Dole Corporation spent millions on a campaign to vilify the orange.
Yeah, I get it, you're an outcast. Always under attack, always coming in last. Bring it up the bass, no one owes you anything, I think. You need a shotgun blast.
Hey kids, welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. Got a ton of ground to cover here, hoping to keep it under 90 minutes. Last one was a bit long, broke the record I think. I'm doing my best not to duplicate that, but I did love the feedback that I got from the episode with Nathan. It was a lot more than I could have asked for, so it was great having him on. Hope to have him again. Listen, this isn't about food, what I'm about to talk about here, but it's kind of crazy. Did you hear about this curse of the Best Actress Oscar? Did you hear about this? This dude, Jesse James, who, I don't know, he looks a little troubled, all right? I mean, the guy looks like he's kind of a... He's from the wrong side of town. He's married to Sandra Bullock. 2 days after she wins her Oscar, word gets out that he's been cheating on her with this ex-porn star skank. This, I don't even remember her name. She's got tattoos everywhere. So, I didn't even know this. I guess I knew it, but I didn't think about it. Sandra Bullock, Halle Berry, Gwyneth Paltrow, Hilary Swank, Reese Witherspoon, Julia Roberts, Kate Winslet, and Charlize Theron, all divorced within a year of winning the Oscar. Can you believe that? And Sandra Bullock didn't even last a freaking week. And listen, I don't judge a book by its cover. I don't. Well, sometimes I do, but not often. This Jesse James dude, one look at this guy and you're like, ugh, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like... You know, he's tatted, he works on bikes, he's a bad boy, kind of looks like she went dumpster diving for a bad guy, you know? And listen, if you play with that kind of fire, you're going to get some rug burns, you know what I mean? Going to get some heat. So this bastard cheats on her with this ex-porn star, I don't remember her name, all tatted up. This chick has tattoos on her face, tattoos all the way around. Did you see the pictures of her? She's nasty looking. Forehead tattoo. I mean... That's Mike Tyson type of crazy. And that's really nuts. Anyway, unfortunate. And here, you know, your heart went out to them because they lost their dog about a month ago and they finally found the dog. And it just seemed like, you know, all right, the guy's a bad boy, but eh, whatever. He's probably a nice guy. Well, I guess not. Anyway, I'm having a canned craft beer this week. Oscar Blues Gubna. Imperial IPA. It's a double IPA, Imperial West Coast style IPA. I know we've talked about Oscar Blues before on the show, long time ago. Did Dale's Pale Ale. Actually, very good beer. I first found out about it at the GABF years ago. And they make a lot of great beers. 1050 is the Imperial Stout. I know I did a write-up on that one. I think I paired it with... No, I didn't pair it with something. I just wrote about it. Hump Day Happiness, that's what that was. It was. It appeared on Doug's site, humpdayhappiness.com. What was the other one that we had? Old Chub, that was a great beer, like a Scottish ale. But you'd think for a second here, it's amazing that a brewery that cans beer instead of bottling, because, you know, bottled beer is pretty much customary, you wouldn't think canned beer would be this good. But let me tell you something. Forget all that you know about canned beer. This is awesome. To repeat myself, because I've talked about this before, you get beer like this in a can. It doesn't taste like it's got, you know, like it's been in a can. Because they're lined with this polyurethane stuff or this plastic stuff that doesn't have any flavor. so you don't get that. And it keeps light out, so you don't get skunky beer. It gets cold faster. And I think one of the reasons why they started canning their beer in the first place was because they have a lot of people in Colorado who like to go hiking, backpacking. So they wanted to backpack some beers in, and, you know, you can drink the beer, smash the can into this little disc, and you can pack it out easily. So you don't have to leave cans laying around. So that's really the idea. Anyway, Gubna is an Imperial IPA, 10% ABV, and I'm going to open it in the can. Listen to this here. Prove I'm in a can. You want one? That's an inside joke. Katrina will get it in her car, probably. Anyway, that was for her. This, I'm going to pour it in a glass. Nice, little deep golden color. Not really red, but getting there. Nice big fat head. And it smells really fruity. I mean, woof. Seriously, pineapple, orange zest, you name it. It's a really nice fat nose on this thing. You can smell the hops, too. I do not know what kind of hops they're using, but it's awfully similar to smelling like Pliny. I'll taste it. And there's the citrus. Grapefruit, really fruity malt mouthfeel. Lots of citrus, lemon. And Jesus, H and a half Christ, it's boozer. Oh, you will get in trouble here, man. This is very strong alcohol flavor. You can really taste that. It's a little thick. I can tell it's going to kick you in the ass a little later, so. Ooh, phenomenal. That is strong. But I love it. Oscar Blues, it's a brewery. It's in Lyons, Colorado. It's a brewery that doesn't apologize for anything. They don't apologize the way their cans look. I mean, they've got a really, everything's always fat and chunky. They use a little Futura a couple times in a couple of their cans. They'll use Futura, which I like, nice typeface. But the rest of it's kind of chunky and 60s looking. And their packaging is very low frills. And it's in a can, for Christ's sake. It's nothing fancy. But they do deliver when it counts. And I do kind of have an issue with the price. $15 for a 4-pack, 12-ounce cans. I mean, those are Pennsylvania prices, man. Not to say it's not worth the money. I'm just saying at this price, I could be drinking Pliny. Not to say it's not up there with Pliny, but it is no Pliny. But it's damn good. What's that figure out? Figure out about $3.60 a can, I think. And that's not horrible. If you figure, do the math, you get a 16-ounce bottle of Pliny for about $4 or $5 here on the West Coast. So it's not bad. Anyway, so we need something to choke down with this beer. Right? And I've got just the thing. You all know that I have this infatuation with pho. Pho became my ultimate comfort food, my death row meal. Years of working with Vietnamese people pretty much set me up for this cuisine that I knew nothing about before. And now it's revered. It's one of my favorite cuisines. Seriously, there's no more perfect dish to me than a bowl of pho. It's nice, hearty broth, chewy noodles, and meat. What I didn't know about was this sandwich of Vietnam, banh mi. If there's anything positive that came out of the French occupation of Vietnam, it was that the Vietnamese people learned how to make bread. They kept that. Fresh French baguettes. Nothing comes close to a French baguette. It's crunchy on the outside. It's soft and buttery on the inside. It's like the perfect loaf of bread. That is the basis of a banh mi. I didn't even know this sandwich existed until one day I'm reading Bon Appetit magazine. And there was this article in there about the best sandwiches in the world. There was the banh mi, nice big baguette, few slices of meat, maybe some barbecued pork, cilantro, and jalapenos. I'm like, what the hell is that? I'd never heard of it. 2 days later, I discover Gastronomy Blog, Kathy's site, gastronomyblog.com. Friend of Joe's. I met her through her. Turns out she's got like 10 posts on this sandwich, and I'm losing my freaking mind. These things are everywhere, obviously, throughout Los Angeles and Orange County. I'd never seen a single one of them. And the first problem that I have with stuff like this is the fact that I'm white. I'm a round eye. I know it. I'm okay with it. And I can't pronounce most things that aren't in English because I suck at it. Language is not my strength. I play to my strengths. Language isn't one of them. How in the hell do you say banh mi? D The internet was absolutely no help. I got bun my, bon me, ban my, and even I asked my Mac, listen to what my Mac had to say.
Bon me.
Hey, that sounds delicious.
Bon me.
So I did the right thing. I asked the one person that I knew would know, Catherine at Gastronomy Blog. I love Kathy. She's a great writer. She's really super nice person, takes great photographs of her food, and best of all, she's Vietnamese. And I love Vietnamese people. They're warm. I've known so many in my life, and they're always nice, kind, warm people, genuinely care, and they know how to have a good time, and they cook the single best thing I have ever had in my life, my death row meal, pho. Now, how do you say pho properly? Bourdain says pho. Other people say pho. Some people say pho. I don't know what the hell that came from. You say pho, like a question. Look at how pho is written, if you'll notice. The O kind of looks like it has a squiggly question mark on it. It's like asking a question. Pho? Like, would you like to have some pho? Well, look at banh mi. Look at how it's spelled. B-A-N-H. A has this little ramp going up. Well, that ramp means banh, like you're going up. And then mi going down is mi. Banh mi. That's what she told me. She goes, you want to impress some people? Say it like that. So, that is how you say it. Now, what the hell is it? Here's what it is. Sliced meats, like ham bone, head cheese, pork roll, pate, sliced cured pork, pork meatballs, Chinese barbecued pork topped with house pickles, like daikon radish, carrots, onions, jalapenos, cilantro, some house mayonnaise, and maybe a spritz of soy sauce. I'm going to tell you something right off the bat here. Subway can take their $5 footlong and suck it. You know what a banh mi sandwich costs? 10-inch sandwich, $2.75. $2.75. Let me tell you something. That's 10 hard inches of crunchy goodness. No filler. If you're not getting cheap filler like bag shredded lettuce, right? It's a no-frills sandwich. You got a few slices of meat tucked right in there, some cilantro, jalapeno, pickled carrots, pickled radish. Depending on the sandwich, maybe a sauce, maybe not. Perfectly packed into a freshly baked French baguette. And like I said, if there was anything that came out of that French occupation of Vietnam that was a positive, it was the bread. And for God's sake, the coffee. Iced coffee there. It's awesome. Strong and sweet. They have lattes, Americano, French coffee, you name it. It's like going into a Starbucks and a Subway all together, just less expensive. And there's a chain here in America that makes these sandwiches throughout the country available to you. It's called Lee's. They're based out of San Jose, so there's a ton of them here in California. Northern California, Southern California, and they're expanding to other parts of the country too. Arizona, Oklahoma, Texas. More states on their way, I'm sure. So if you live in or near any of those states, you find yourself going there, you're going to be in the neighborhood, check out leesandwiches.com. See for yourself. Listen, under $3, you're not going to taste a better sandwich than the banh mi. And they make a lot of other sandwiches, too. Oh, they make their own bread. I should say that. I didn't mention that. The baguettes and the croissants, all house-made. That's what makes Subway sandwiches so tasty. You walk into a Subway, you ever smell that? Oh, they bake their own bread. I like Subway. Don't get me wrong. But I like this more. Those croissants, they have ham and cheese, turkey and cheese, salami and cheese, veggie, avocado, lots of vegetarian options. You can get regular sandwiches. You don't have to have the Asian sandwiches. They make salami and cheese, ham and cheese, turkey, club sandwich, you name it. It's a regular sandwich shop, but they offer this special Asian sandwich, and it's awesome. If you go, I suggest trying at least one of these sandwiches. It's one of the most unique flavor combinations I've ever had in a sandwich. And visit gastronomyblog.com. She's got a lot of information on there, on these sandwiches, a lot of other stuff. I can't do it justice like Kathy can. I told her I want to talk about it, but I know you've got more information to offer than I do, so I'm sending you there. In fact, she gave me a link for you guys to check out on her blog. It lists all of her banh mi visits, so you can see more on her site. I'll directly link just to that.
The fact is that we all need to eat, and the question tonight is really, how do you eat well, how do you eat affordably, and eat safely? We went to Tom Colicchio's kitchen today to find out. He, of course, is the star of Top Chef. He's also the creator of numerous restaurants here in New York, Craft Bar, Witchcraft, and now another restaurant, Colicchio & Sons.
Were you surprised to hear about this testimony about slaughterhouses?
Not at all, no. There were some documentaries done recently showing sort of the inside and inner workings of slaughterhouses. So, no, I'm not surprised at all. In fact, I think it's a good thing that someone's blowing the whistle because our food supply needs to stay safe. I think it's important. I think USDA is charged with that, and they're not doing their job.
What are the biggest dangers for people in the kitchen? I mean, it's what, E. coli, salmonella?
Well, E. coli is the big issue, and E. coli is a surface bacteria. And so usually if it's on a steak, when you sear the steak or cook the steak, you'll kill the bacteria. But the problem is when you're eating burgers and that bacteria is ground into beef and it's not cooked at a high enough temperature, the interior is not cooked at a high enough temperature to kill it. And so that's the real issue.
So what do you recommend? I mean, someone who's watching this at home, what do you recommend in terms of how they should buy their food?
Well, I would stay away from frozen beef patties.
Why?
Well, because they're usually come from bigger packers and large-scale manufacturers of food. I would go to a butcher and make sure that it's coming from a shoulder, it's coming from a single muscle that's ground in. Usually, a shoulder is less likelihood that E. coli will contaminate a shoulder versus a frozen patty packer where they're taking a whole animal and grinding the whole animal. So you have belly cuts that have a less likelihood of having E. coli on it.
But a lot of that, I mean, buying local, buying from a butcher, I mean, all that costs more money.
It's expensive.
A lot of people just don't have that kind of money.
Without a doubt, it's much more expensive. I think that people should eat higher quality foods, beef, pork, chicken, and maybe eat less of that, and look toward maybe fish for protein.
So maybe eat meat a little bit less, but eat higher quality.
Eat higher quality, exactly. I mean, even chickens, you can buy chickens for $1 a pound or $4 a pound. There's a difference between the way the animal's being raised and processed.
Are there alternatives to eating meats like these that you can still get a lot of protein from?
Sure, there's legumes like lentils, there's vegetables. I think right now I'm trying to at least have one meal where I'm not eating protein. I'm focusing more on vegetables or legumes to get that protein.
You do that one meal a week?
I'm trying to, yeah.
How's that
working? It's not always working, but I try.
But it is, I mean, something like this, lentils, which taste really good, are really affordable.
Sure. It's they're very inexpensive. You just have to cook a little bit. You have to learn how to cook.
I talked to a chef once who told me they thought vegetables were sexy.
They are. Look at them. They're great. That's not so sexy.
What's sexy about vegetables?
Well, I mean, it's that's a little more sexy than, say, a cut of meat, I guess. I don't know.
So as you know by now, Food Inc. did not win the Best Documentary Oscar. That went to The Cove, as I kind of predicted it would. Very well deserved, by the way. Great movie. Food Inc. started a cult following, and I think I did my best to promote the film and a lot of the issues that were brought up in it. But there was this anti-Food Inc. sentiment out there that I didn't voice on the show. And looking back, maybe it was a bit irresponsible for me to do that, because my show is not all opinion. My goal here, always, is to bring discussion to the table to get you to discuss and think and challenge these issues that I talk about on the show. The opinions that I have, those are mine. And listen, they're rarely ever on the money, but they're my opinions because we're all entitled to those. Now, did I side with the filmmakers of Food Inc.? Yes, I did. Why? Because they brought these claims, and they showed the inside of that chicken coop, which turned my stomach, and Tyson refused to talk to the producers of the movie. There are a lot of things they talked about in that movie, not just the poultry thing, that I absolutely agree with, and that they are part of my everyday life. There are some heroes of mine in that movie, Michael Pollan, Eric Schlosser, that farmer from Polyface Farms, a total nut, but I love him. He's got a great outlook. There's nothing wrong with having farmers as heroes. I think it's a positive thing if you're really into food and you really want to respect food. Having a farmer, as a friend or as a mentor or someone that you look up to is a positive. Companies like Tyson have spoken to the press before, and the press has turned their words around on them. So they stop talking to the press. They want large corporations like Tyson to be the bad guy, so they can continue to sell newspapers, magazines, books, and make documentaries just like Food Inc. Now, I'm not taking a side here. I'm simply giving you the other side of the coin because I failed to do that before. I want you to think about what I'm about to say. Make your own decisions, of course, but just so you know, that woman that they interviewed who showed you what it looked like inside her chicken coop, she was running a very poor operation, not indicative of how most Tyson growers run their farms. Most growers for companies like Tyson have state-of-the-art chicken coops with drip systems, ventilation, a relatively clean operation. She apparently put no money back into her operation at all, and that's why it looked the way it did. God knows what she was doing with her money, but she certainly wasn't putting it back into her business. Never upgraded her operation for whatever reason, and therefore has issues with chickens dying, disease, and producing a very poor product. Now, given the facts in the movie that these chicken farmers are forced to upgrade their gear and basically make no money raising poultry, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that anybody would want to be in that business. As you're watching that movie, you think to yourself, why would anybody do this for a living? But on the other hand, there have been successful chicken growers for years, decades in fact, family operations that date back to the early 1900s. It's an industry that makes a lot of money, and the growers make a living. So I'm given some information to contact a media representative for Tyson. I sent him an email. Of course, I asked him if he might want to come on. Of course, I told him I'm pretty sure he wouldn't be able to do that, given, you know, what I was told about Tyson and the fact that they don't talk to the press about this stuff. And he emailed me an official statement from Tyson Foods on Food Inc. specifically. And I'm going to read that to you now. Food Inc.'s distorted view of the food industry is disappointing, especially when you think of all the people at a company like Tyson who work hard to produce safe, high-quality foods in a responsible way. In fact, the food we produce for others is the same food we feed our own families. What goes on in our operations is no secret. Federal food safety inspectors are present in our fresh meat and poultry plants every moment they're in operation. They are also subject to inspection by regulators who monitor such areas as workplace safety, environmental protection, and employment compliance. In fact, the meat and poultry industry is already one of the most regulated industries in the country. Tyson operates by a set of core values as well as a code of conduct. In other words, we strive to run our business in an ethical, responsible way and in compliance with the law. As part of our efforts to operate responsibly, our company employs experts and specialists who focus on such important areas as food safety, worker safety, animal well-being, employment compliance, and environmental management. We have previously given fair-minded journalists access to our meat and poultry operations and consented to interviews. However, we declined the Food Inc. filmmakers' request for an interview because we believed they were on an anti-food industry crusade and we would not be treated fairly. The movie has confirmed our suspicions about their true motives. In addition, since the film's producers raised no specific questions about Tyson's operations, we referred them to the National Chicken Council for information about the overall poultry industry. An NCC representative was subsequently interviewed for the film. Unfortunately, very little of the information he provided was used. Contrary to the impression left in the film, companies like Tyson continue to depend on the family farmers and ranchers of rural America to help us produce food from the independent hog farmer in Iowa and cattle rancher in Texas to the poultry farmer in states like Arkansas, Mississippi, and Georgia. In addition, Tyson provides a wide variety of food products to meet the needs of today's consumers, including those people looking for more healthful food options. For example, we offer chicken nuggets and patties with whole grain breading to food service customers such as schools. Chicken nuggets. Ugh. I'm not a fan. I don't even know what part of a chicken that is. Anyway, for more information on the myths and misleading information present in Food Inc., we encourage you to visit safefoodinc.org. Now, you go to this safefoodinc.org site, right? And it looks fairly generic, maybe even set up like the same kind of propaganda pieces that the films, the filmmakers in Food Inc., they laid those examples out of smiling farmers, happy customers, and healthy chickens. So you're left with this question that hangs, who are you going to believe, the filmmakers or Tyson? So you've got to kind of make that decision, whether you've already made it or given this some more thought, and maybe you would kind of think that maybe they were kind of looking for trouble when they made the film. I was also given this AP piece to read to you, and this came out, I think, right after the movie opened. Claims made in the new film Food Inc. were challenged by Janet Riley, Senior Vice President of Public Affairs for the American Meat Institute, during an interview with ABC's Nightline that aired June 18th. Food Inc. makes allegations about food production broadly and specifically about the meat industry's animal welfare, food safety, nutrition, and hiring practices. The film's co-producer, Eric Schlosser, who is also the author of Fast Food Nation and who appears extensively throughout the film, said it's really just three or four companies controlling the meat. Last week, the film opened in three cities and will be released in additional cities this weekend. I've been in this industry for 18 years, and for me, it was like going to see a film about modern investigative techniques and having Scooby-Doo show up on the screen, Ms. Riley said. It was a caricature. Ms. Riley detailed the aggressive and unique oversight of humane handling practices in place in meatpacking plants in response to the film's claims about animal welfare. The film also features a scene in which a family goes through a drive-thru restaurant, orders burgers, colas, and french fries, and suggests this is the only way they can afford to eat due to economic and time constraints. The mother said she felt guilty feeding her family this way. Ms. Riley said, I objected to the idea that somehow these people were being forced to buy certain foods and forced to eat in their cars. I actually went online because I didn't believe it. I was able to put together three different meals for $16 to $18, and I guarantee you that there would have been leftovers from what I cooked. Now listen, as a side note here, I absolutely agree with this. That part of the movie pissed me off. These lazy bastards couldn't cook at home. They walk into a market and couldn't afford to buy two pears, but they could afford to eat at McDonald's. You remember what Nathan said in the last interview, the last episode? He said the amount of calories that are in a Big Mac, he could put out the caloric equivalent in produce in front of you, that if you did manage to finish it all, would fill you up so much, you wouldn't want to eat the rest of the day. Seriously. And you wouldn't spend that kind of money. Ms. Riley responded to claims that the industry would not agree to participate in the film during the interview, noting that Mr. Lobb did appear on behalf of the chicken industry and that AMI was never contacted. She also showed producer correspondence between her and Mr. Schlosser dating back to 2005, in which Ms. Riley tried to arrange a meeting with Mr. Schlosser. He wrote back and said he would be willing to meet but never committed to a time or place. Ms. Riley sent another letter on June 9th, iterating AMI's request for a meeting. These comments were not included in the Nightline piece. As a result, AMI, NCC, and a coalition of trade associations have collaborated to produce SafeFoodInc.com, a new website that responds to the film's claims. So, there you have it. That's Tyson's response. That's a response from the American Meat Institute. They claim the makers of Food Inc. hate the food industry and that it was a smear campaign and basically started, you know, just that. Which they did very well. I wanted to share that with you and maybe get your thoughts on that. What do you think? Is Tyson full of crap? Is meat really safe? Are these videos that we see, are they PETA generated? A lot of them, yeah. Are they true? Well, tell me. I mean, is that happening all the time? According to Tyson, according to AMI, the National Chicken Council, no. It's not. It happens infrequently. Are the pieces that we play from CNN, are they the real deal? Or are they propaganda pieces directed at consumers? I gotta wonder, that last one we played last episode sure sounded like they were setting those people up. I don't know. Because consumers will believe anything you tell them. So you scare them into purchasing their food from other sources. That happens all the time. You gotta wonder, man. How do you feel about this? I wanna know. And thanks to Gary Mickelson at Tyson Foods for sending me that information. I appreciate it very much. Planet Green is debuting a new show March 30th called Future Food. It's got molecular gastronomy chefs Humaro Kantu and Ben Roche. You know, Ben Roche was on No Reservations with Tony Bourdain when he went to Chicago. He does a lot of molecular gastronomy stuff. He was the one that handed him the menu and says, you read the menu and then you can eat it. The menu is edible. And then he made food that looked like roadkill, but it wasn't. It was like Rice Krispies. It was supposed to look like maggots or something. It was just ridiculous. Anyway, the guy's a little nuts. His show is an interesting take because it focuses on these chefs that look for solutions for some of the world's environmental issues through their cooking. So it's unique in that way. They'll show you what it's like to run a real restaurant business with some of the coolest toys and gadgets known to man. Molecular gastronomy is really not dead. People think it is, but it's not. And a show like this is going to give anybody who's interested in molecular cooking a giant boner. I think it's the kind of food show anybody who's interested in molecular gastronomy, you're going to eat it up.
Every week, they'll take on a new challenge.
This is extreme cuisine here.
To make the impossible possible.
It's the process of innovation that interests me.
That's really good.
He's like the scientist of food.
Why wait for the future when the future is now?
The all-new series Future Food premieres Tuesday, March 30th at 10 on Planet Green.
So I got to tell you, I actually did something that I've never tried before. I contacted the media representative at Discovery as I was trying to get an interview with somebody who worked on the show. Specifically, wanted to talk to the hosts, but never heard back from them. And that's cool. I'm just a podcast. But I tried, and I will continue to try. And I've known for a while that Bourdain, because I just mentioned him, he's got a bit of a hard-on for food bloggers. You know? He doesn't care for food bloggers all that much. I'm taking it. I think he thinks we're too obsessive about it. Doesn't want us to shoot pictures of it, just eat it. And why try to write about it so much? He says, doesn't it get in the way of you actually enjoying the food? He said, writing about food or taking pictures of it as you're eating it is kind of like keeping a diary while you're having sex. And I'll play some clips for you. But he's actually talking to these three guys who started an online food community a few years ago. And they ended up breaking up. They were fighting. And then lawyers got involved, and they just got angry, just really angry at each other. And these guys are all just nasty looking, hot mess, fat dudes. But this isn't the first time he's taken shots at bloggers on his show before.
Food blogging, eating and then writing about it. Harmless activity? Perhaps not. Hotbed of hostility, broken friendships, businesses ripped asunder, food blogging. It may look harmless, but is it?
You know, some people go to drugs, some people go to alcohol, some people go to food.
An enthusiasm for the world of restaurants and casual eateries, and a desire to share those passions.
If I love something and believe in it, I want everybody to know about it.
It's something in our soul that needs to be expressed.
These food blogger dudes, you know, they're arguing, always fighting. You know, it's just food. A little disturbing.
Do you think there's a danger of overanalyzing? I mean, just a hamburger, man. I mean, it's a good one. I'm a little concerned about this, actually. What makes it so good is all you're thinking about is how great it tastes and, you know, that grease is running down your chin, yep. You're tasting the onions, and it's all good. If you stop to think about it or to take pictures, doesn't it? I mean, that's sort of like, it's just sort of like keeping a diary while you're having sex.
So we're trying to do the same thing that you're doing. We're trying to share our experiences. And not everybody, of course, can fly to, like, Southeast Asia.
I asked Jason what he thinks is wrong with him and bloggers like him.
And maybe for some of us, it's trying to make up for something that is lacking in our life.
It's an empty spot in your soul, a dissatisfied area of your nature that you're looking to fill.
Yeah.
You know, it's these food blogger dudes. You know, God bless, we need them. We live and breathe by them. The future of food journalism is in their chubby paws. But I sense anger. You know, you shouldn't be angry when you eat.
What brought you to writing about food, blogging about food?
It's a compulsion. I used to be a lawyer. And so when I started eating really great food at great restaurants, I became completely obsessed with it. And I abandoned my career as a lawyer to write about food. And I was going to be the next restaurant reviewer for the New York Times.
Great meeting.
After about a year of sending stuff to the New York Times and having it rejected, I thought, you know, maybe I should take like the 200 restaurant reviews that I've now written and have never been published, and I should put them online. And so I did that. And
was that a sensible business decision?
Well, I'm poor, but I eat like a billionaire.
Why did you want to write about food in the first place? Why was it not enough to eat food?
If I love something and believe in it, I want everybody to know about it.
I kind of feel like this guy does, too. You know, hey, you know, you go to Southeast Asia, Russia, Europe, Africa. You film yourself eating all this great food all the time. What's different about what you do and what we're doing? You know, we're equally as passionate as you are. No, we can't afford to travel to all these places, so we stay local and we write what we're passionate about. What's wrong with that? And it is true, too, that we're all attention whores. We want people to know what we're thinking. We want fame in some way, or we wouldn't be doing this on the internet. That part is true. But it's also true of Bourdain. So that's a pot calling the kettle black. We've all got a bit of narcissism in us, right? But at least I admit it. And I don't write all that much, but still, I don't understand what his problem is with food bloggers. And this could go for anybody who has a blog. Seriously, think about it. If you wrote about dogs or beer or sports or movies, You know, he'd ask the question, why can't you just enjoy the movie? Why do you have to write about everyone that you see? Maybe because that person's passionate about it. And maybe Bourdain is the only one who's allowed to have passion.
Thank you, food bloggers. Please continue your heroic, nerdly ways.
The best part of the whole episode is finding out that Bourdain is on cholesterol meds. You know, I knew he stopped smoking, which I figured was his wife telling him, you know, yelling at him. Listen, Tony, you got to stop or smoke. You're going to kill our baby girl if you smoke a lock of the chimney all the time. She nags the shit out of him, man. It's nasty. You know, I just went through a scare. I was worried that my cholesterol would be really high, but it wasn't. As it turns out, Bourdain, his eating finally caught up to him, man. And it's a warning shot that we all need to watch out.
My name is Anthony Bourdain. I'm 53 years old, and I'm on freaking cholesterol meds. In the cold, cruel, fake cheerful tones that only doctors can use when giving you the bad news, mine began a list of things I'd have to do without. It was one body blow after another. Because my cholesterol level was too high, first he said,
no butter. Okay. No, actually, it was more like, my God, no! Butter? I can't live without butter. And then I thought, okay, wait a minute. In Italy, they get by with good olive oil.
Maybe I could do without. Then he said, no cheese. Soft, stinky, triple cream cheeses? I guess I could cut back. Then he said no pork.
Pork?
As in fatty pork belly, crispy pigtails, whole roasted piglets dripping fat from their crispy skin.
No pork? Wait a minute. That I can't do without. It came down to this for me. I mean, it was a choice. Take the drug, acknowledge your own mortality and decrepitude, or give up pork. Well, I think we know which side of the argument I came down on. So, when my liver explodes and start having a, you know, brain bleed in the middle of the show, it's your fault, my piggy friend. Stay with me, my love. I would treat you well.
I love it. You know, you're totally addicted to something when the doctor tells you got to take meds or you got to quit eating this stuff. And you say, give me the meds. It's like me and my pho, my ramen soups. I know they're laced with sodium, but I refuse to give it up. I'll take all the blood pressure medication they give me as long as I can continue to eat my soup.
To enjoy a taco from one of San Antonio's newest restaurants, That Taco Shop, all you have to do is call.
And so they don't have to leave work and they can just make the phone call and have the food brought to them.
Food delivery is one of life's conveniences that if you're willing to pay for it, most can enjoy. Now including inmates at the Bexar County Jail.
It's a privilege that we allow the inmates, provided they behave and they follow all the rules.
Starting this month, if the institutional dinner doesn't satisfy an inmate's taste buds, he or his family can order up a jumbo cheeseburger with fries instead. Even a pizza, wings, nachos are all available online, but at a price.
It generates a little money for the county.
By allowing iCare Food Services to offer food delivery to inmates, the company has agreed to give the county nearly a third of the proceeds. The county expects to bring in $15,000 this year from the program. Money, some say, is just not worth it.
They say inmates should not be given any such privileges.
One noticeable absence from the inmates' menu, especially for San Antonio, is tacos. To have that delivered, one must live on the outside, at least for now.
Have you ever made a delivery down to the jail?
No, not yet, sir.
Hey, I'm looking forward to a lot of things this spring, but nothing on my schedule am I looking to more than visiting Raina Foff's place next weekend. She's invited us for dinner, and I can't wait. You guys know how much I love her food. The interesting thing is, and why I'm bringing this up, is I have one more thing from CNN I want to play. And I know I'm playing a lot today, but there's a lot going on. I remember asking Afaf a question on the show that always comes to me whenever I see food shows in the Middle East or Africa. And I swear to God, I don't know why. I just can't get this out of my head. Right now, I want you to do something. It's an experiment. Unless you're driving, don't do it. Close your eyes. Think of the Middle East. What do you see? What's the first thing that pops in your head? Think of Africa. What do you see? You know what I see? Desert. Hot, dry desert. No water. Just heat and sand. But I know it's not like that because whenever you see it on television, that's what you see. Lots of sun, very little water. However, they eat a lot of produce. Spinach, cucumbers, fruit, produce up the ass, green stuff, where is it coming from? I asked Afaf this question. She goes, oh, we have farms, they grow this stuff. I'm sure they do or they wouldn't have this food. I want to see one of these farms so I can stop thinking that the Middle East is nothing but dirt and dry and hostile place, you know? It's not that bad. It's not that kind of a place to live. They get rain. Listen, I checked the weather report for Baghdad the other day. Don't ask me why. I do strange shit sometimes. Anyway, it was 55 degrees and it was raining. It rained for 3 days in a row, in fact. So they do get rain and it does get cold there sometimes. And they grow produce just like we do.
The fertile, vast plains of Kazakhstan represent a real-time solution for the parched desert states of the Middle East. The Central Asian country, the size of Western Europe, is one of a dozen targets popping up on the radar for governments in search of food security.
I think a lot of countries, especially in the Middle East, had to rethink about their food supply. And I think it's basically a new paradigm in food and food processing.
This market in Bahrain is bursting with imported vegetables from Europe. But a year ago, prices were skyrocketing, and there were shortages of all kinds, even for the basics such as bread. The food crisis caught the region flat-footed and ill-prepared to deal with surging global demand. As a result, double-digit inflation became the norm, forcing governments to look for drastic solutions. Egyptian Trade and Industry Minister Rashid Rashid personally combed the world for wheat, with visits to Russia and Central Asia attempting to meet domestic demand of 6 million tons a year.
The fact that you know that you need this much quantity to feed the people in Egypt and knowing that there is not enough quantity around the world makes you really scared.
Scared enough for Egypt to try and raise $12 billion from investors to set up an agricultural zone to complement traditional hubs for textiles and furniture. Buyers, especially oil and gas-rich Saudi Arabia and Qatar, have concentrated their efforts for farmland in eastern and southern Africa, with Sudan, Uganda, Zambia, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Madagascar taking top billing. The latter two are sparking controversy on the ground with claims by locals of neocolonialism.
I think the specific issue about agriculture is it's potentially more emotive because there are issues about potentially displacement of people, about potentially issues with property rights. But I come back to the point, providing it's executed sensibly and properly and worked in partnership with local people, it can be very much a win-win.
Atkin, whose firm advises buyers, says the oil-rich countries can offer new technology, the promise to employ local workers, and most importantly, capital to expand. At the recent World Islamic Economic Forum in Jakarta, food security topped the agenda. Regional leaders are encouraging Islamic trade and investment. With a market of 1.6 billion Muslim people worldwide, projects for halal food can be scaled up to meet the needs of the parched but wealthy Gulf states. Already, Middle East investors have spread to Asia to include countries such as Indonesia, Malaysia, Cambodia, and Vietnam.
They will invest in infrastructure. This means in road, in all infrastructure, irrigation. And at the same time, they develop the land. Of course, they will have a big portion of that. And any exports will be for their interest to export these products to GCC countries. I think this is of mutual interest.
That is the prevailing view now. And last year's shortage was enough to keep the search for land and food alive and well.
Okay, kids, that's all I have for you this week. Thanks for listening. Look around for banh mi. If you have a pho noodle house near you, chances are you'll be able to find a banh mi sandwich shop too. Okay? If there's a Vietnamese population, that's usually there's one pho place and there'll be a sandwich shop. Ask around or Google it. Don't forget to check out Kathy's blog, gastronomyblog.com. She's got a ton of photos, information about these sandwiches all throughout the LA area. Special thanks to CNN, The Onion, Planet Green, and Travel Channel for the audio, and Tyson Foods for their cooperation with that press release. Music on this episode from Shine Down. If you like the song, you can download it from the iTunes store. Check the link on our website, or better yet, from Shine Down's website, shinedown.com. My name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie, and I'll see you next time. Take
to explain that the darkest hour never comes in the night. You can sleep with the cat.